Reading, it comes from, we're going to be doing a little transition. It's Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. And today's sermon title is Made Alive with Christ. Again, today's scripture reading, it comes from Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. And today's sermon title is Made Alive with Christ. This is God's holy and inerrant word, starting in verse 1. And you were dead in your trespasses and sin, in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, like the rest of mankind. But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. This is the word of the Lord.
Good morning. In light of the events of yesterday that Nick referred to earlier, we are going to do something a little bit different today that we hardly will ever do. I woke up this morning, literally, got some feedback last night, woke up this morning, realized that the sermon that I worked on this last week is not going to work for this morning. It would be a hard message in any time, talking about Abraham offering up his son Isaac. But there are times when things going on in the rest of the world sort of ramp up the emotional temperature. They make it a little harder to hear, to think about the kinds of things that I think that passage really deals with. And it would end up, I think, being a little bit more detrimental than actually helpful. We will come back to Hebrews next week. That passage is in Scripture. That means that we have to be able to deal with it, face it head on. Actually gets referenced in another place, but I think it's probably not best for today. What do I want to try to do today? I would like to give us something of a framework that's always true, one that we easily forget, but a framework that might help you think through not only what took place yesterday, but also as our country will probably continue to grapple with this, not just today, but for a number of days, certainly as we continue to pursue the election cycle on into the fall. And so I would like to give you some ways to think about these kinds of things for yourself, but also things that you can hold on to when you're in conversations with your friends, coworkers, but especially with your children. These are things that I've been thinking about for us for a while. I'm very grateful for the guys being able to make some adjustments this morning for our service. I think these things are important for us. My apologies for reading most of this today, as it's not there. First thing that you need to hang on to this week comes from verse 3 of this passage. That at our most fundamental level, for all of our secondary differences, none of us are any different in God's eyes. Why is that going to be important to hang on to? I very much appreciate hearing all the denunciations of violence, how there is no room for it in our political process. That should go without saying. That's right for us to reinforce. That's why we prayed the way we did this morning. But I'm noticing already that there is a focus not on what happened, but on why it happened, on why someone worked deliberately to end another person's life. And I'm noticing people are debating, asking, what's the real cause behind this? Some are focusing on our language, how our word choices over the last number of decades, more recently, have become increasingly violent. How our rhetoric is rage-influenced and rage-inducing. People are saying that's the cause. Other people are talking about how easily unstable people are manipulated, how they can be moved to doing horrific things. Others are focusing on the increasing polarization in our country, how the power struggle has become more intense, more active, and more violent. Others are trying to figure out who's actually using this to their advantage. And I think what you're going to hear over this next week is who is to blame for this? And I'm going to make a prediction. In trying to answer that question, the answer is always, almost always, if you force me to qualify, almost always going to be someone other than me. And so you're going to hear it. You're hearing it already. It's language and actions that are used by the left. That language and actions used by the right, that's responsible. It's going to be someone over there, not over here, who is at the cause of all of this. Someone who's nothing at all like me. What you're not going to hear, I don't think you'll hear this, is someone who says anything like verse 3 that we just read. That we all, used that word, all once lived in the passions of our flesh. That we all, from God's perspective, the entire human race, every last soul, has the same starting point. That we all were on one side of the room together, and that it was not the same side of the room as God was on. I don't think you're going to hear that. I don't think you're going to hear anything like the preacher Robert Murray McChain, who said, "The seed of every sin known to mankind is in my heart." You're not going to hear, popularly, that in every one of our hearts lurk all of the same sins as those in every person who was at the rally yesterday, and in every rally of every stripe in every country throughout time and history. You're not going to hear that our similarities are greater than our differences, and that they happen here at the level of our heart. You're not going to hear that, yes, we have secondary differences, but that on a fundamental level of a human being, we're all the same. That every one of us starts life dead in our trespasses and sin, and that we all start life living in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and mind, and that sometimes we can submerge those passions, sometimes not give in to them, but they're still there in each and every heart, waiting for a moment to express themselves. You're not going to hear that unless you're hearing Scripture. Scripture will tell you that our colors, our ethnicities, do not fundamentally separate us. Scripture will tell you that our political leanings and convictions do not separate us. That our educational levels, our career choices, the neighborhoods that we live in do not separate us. But that we're all on the same side of the room. That we all once lived exactly the same way, driven by the same things. Yes, we all expressed it differently. But that we ourselves are not fundamentally different from any other human being. And so this week, I'm suggesting that you're going to have a choice. As you scroll through your news feed, you talk to your coworkers, you can either acknowledge the truth of what God says, you can humbly admit your identification with the rest of humanity, or you can join in with the rest of our world by focusing on all of the secondary causes, which are all there, in order to demonstrate that you are not like this person, that person, or the other one. And that you have a plan for how to fix our spiritual deadness without humbly submitting to God's assessment. It's the first thing I think you need to hang on to this week. Here's the second thing. Spiritual deadness is active. Paul starts by saying, "We're dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked." There is an active nature to being spiritually dead. We walk in those sins. What's that mean? He unpacks it in verse 3, that we once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out, active language, carrying out the desires of the body and mind. In other words, spiritual deadness means that you live doing what you feel like doing, doing what your passions drive you to do. We were created to put God in the center of our lives, created to have no other treasure higher than Him. But the essence of evil is to say, no, I want something else there. I want something else more than I want God there. And that's insane. Kids, if you draw a picture for me, and some of you did, Sally and I had them on our island in the kitchen for a number of weeks. If you draw a picture for me, should I love you or the picture more? Obviously you, right? I heard that. It makes sense that I would love you more. You have to be more special than the picture in order to create the picture. You have to be more creative, more intelligent, more beautiful. So if you come and bring me a picture and I spend all of my time talking to the picture and I won't talk to you, I'm valuing the picture more than I'm valuing you. That's what sin is. It's loving something in God's world more than we love God. It's thinking that something that we have here is more special than God, that it's better than him, that we enjoy it more than we enjoy him. That's what spiritual deadness is. It's not that you can't do anything. It's that you keep choosing something else other than God, something less good than he is. Be a little bit if you only ever ate donuts. Men's ministry brings donuts for Sunday school. Donuts are a great treat. What would happen, though, if you only ever ate donuts? You wouldn't be able to grow. Your mind would not be able to work. You'd feel ill. So what would happen if every time you sat down and there was lunch, a great meal here and donuts, and every single time you didn't choose the meal, you chose the donuts? Would you grow anymore? Would you be strong? Would your mind work as well? No. Sounds nice to always go after the donuts. That's what Scripture says are the passions of our flesh. It's not that we don't have the ability to choose anything. It's that we always choose the wrong thing, and we choose a lot of the wrong thing. It's not that we're choosing something bad. Donuts are great as a treat. They are not great as lunch. This is where we're all the same. This is the level at which we identify with each other. This is the way that we can understand each other. We have not all had the same experiences. We will not. Not a single person in this room has had exactly all the same experiences that any other single person has had in this room. We won't all do the same things, but at the level of our passions, at the level of our love for something other than God, at this level, we're all the same, and we're all on the same side of the room. That's why Jesus says things in Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. He said at one point, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who's angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." What's he saying there? He's saying that you get the exact same penalty for those two things, for whether you actually kill someone or whether you're just angry with them. That only makes sense if what is underneath of those things expresses the same thing, expresses itself in different ways, That anger is one expression of your heart and murder is another expression. There are two ways of expressing this passion to get someone out of your presence so that you never, ever have to deal with them again. And Jesus says at this level, at the level of your heart, there is no difference. Let me put a point on it. The passion of the flesh that puts a gun in someone's hand is the same passion of the flesh that makes fun of someone else and mocks them. There's no difference. We're on the same side of the room. God says this is in all of us. It's not the way that we were made to be. That's why when we hear these kind of things, we hate them. We recoil from them. We know this is evil. When you see the video, you know this is evil. We know that when we engage in it, we're participating in something evil. And there is evil in this world. Verse 1, the prince of the power of the air. There is evil at work in you, in me, in our passions. There is evil at work outside of us. As you go from Genesis through Revelation, you discover that evil's number one goal on this earth is to eliminate the image of God, to remove the image of God so that you can no longer see anything on this earth that reminds you, reflects to you who God is. Forget that. Forget evil's goal, and you'll always be surprised at the breadth of what evil is doing in this world. You'll be surprised, and it will just look random and chaotic to you. But worse, forget evil's goal. You may even find yourself working with it in the goal. Maybe not physically murdering someone, but certainly anger and mockery. So I want you to keep in mind that spiritual deadness is active, but it's only active for evil. Because the third point, spiritual deadness is an inability. You can't do real lasting good with the heart that you were born with. The real lasting good of the kind that God thinks is good. This got lost in our world, in the modern Western secular world, somewhere over the last century. Modern world has increasingly used medical metaphors for dealing with issues of the soul. And so we talk in terms of someone who is sick or diseased, that kind of language. I was at a wedding yesterday. During the best man's toast, he shared that the bride used to think he didn't like her. And he clarified to the bride that the rest of us got to listen to. He clarified that he always had liked the bride, but that he had, quote, a terrible RBF. At which point all of the old people at my table leaned in toward each other. That would be me. We all leaned in toward each other, Sally and I and our and friends we were seated with, and said, what's RBF? And all of the younger people in this room are now laughing at me. Your day is coming. There was a day when I was up on everything. But now I have Google. So I quickly Google, what's RBF? I look it up and I discover it's, you all know this, it's what your face looks like when you're relaxed or resting, but it creates an impression that you're angry or annoyed. But because I'm a sociologist, I like looking at these things, so I start scrolling through and reading a bunch of different stuff, and I come across things like this, that it is the phenomenon is real, the condition is common. You think, phenomenon, condition, that's like something that's not part of you. It's some interesting, huh? Or you keep reading and people will ask, does so-and-so have RBF? And you start to think, that's medical ways of talking here. Someone has this condition. What does that communicate? It's not the real person. It's a condition. It's an affliction. It's something that you have. It's not the real you. And there's a cure for it, if you want the cure. That kind of language has seeped into the way that we talk about issues of the heart, issues of the soul, how we think about spirituality. That what's going on inside is not who I really am. And so we think of our souls as sick, as diseased, which means there's something you can do about it, right? See, if you're sick, you can get well. If you're in the hospital, there's treatments. If you're on life support, there's still hope. Paul takes all of that away. He says, you have no ability on your own whatsoever to rehabilitate your soul. You started off dead in your trespasses and sins in what you once walked. When you're dead, you have no hope. You cannot remediate yourself. There's no hope in a dead person of ever producing anything healthy again. The wind's been knocking down branches in our backyard. They break off the trees. Now they're dead. That means there's no hope that they'll ever grow leaves again. There's no hope that they're going to get bigger. No hope that they're going to grow little twigs that then become their own branches. I can go out in the backyard and I can pick up those sticks and I can put them in a glass of water and nothing will happen. I can go out in the backyard, pick up those sticks, and start planting them in the ground, and nothing will happen. I can tie them to the tree, staple them to the tree, cut holes in the tree, and shove them in. Nothing will happen. They're dead. Scripture's verdict is that all people start out life dead, spiritually dead. We all start at the same level of the soul. We all express it differently. But there's not a single one of us that can reform our own soul more than any other can. There is no belief, no thought, no program, no position that you can take, no education that will make a bit of difference to your spiritual deadness. It does not matter which rally you go to, or if you don't go to any rally, it won't make you one bit more spiritually alive. It will not make you one bit less guilty before God. It won't make you any less deserving of his wrath. And if you don't believe that, why would you receive communion today? The cross is the great equalizer. It levels all of us. If you receive communion today, you are physically saying, I need this. I need what Jesus did for me. And if that's what you're saying, then you're saying, there are no degrees of good and bad at the cross. If you need the death of God himself to free you from your own spiritual death, then you can't let yourself think, well, I need God's death a little bit less than someone else does. How can you need less cross than someone else? How can you need less death of God than someone else? You can't. You can't say, well, Jesus only had to die a little bit for me. He only had to be a little bit dead for me, but man, you. He had to really be dead for you. In case I wasn't clear yet, if you're relying on the cross, you have brothers and sisters at political rallies that you would never, ever go to. I'm not talking about Christian nationalism. I'm talking about other Christ followers. Blood-bought saints who will be with you in eternity because they will be with Jesus. People that you now have more in common with than the people who are standing next to them that do not rely on the cross. You and they have more in common with each other. You get each other better than many of the people that you stand next to, that you talk with, that you email with. And the reason for that is because of the fourth thing that I think you need to hang on to this week, that spiritual deadness doesn't have to be final. Verse 4, God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace, you have been saved. You can't make you alive. You can't educate yourself out of death, but God can make you alive. And when you trust Jesus to pay for your spiritual deadness, he makes you alive. You share in his resurrection, not fully and completely yet, but right now, your heart really does. He reorders your passions. He saves you now from what? From the power of sin. So that inside you find new desires. You now actually want to eat lunch, not just donuts. You now want to talk to the person who drew the picture, not just talk to the picture. You now treasure God more than you treasure other things. I have a friend, I told you this story before. She said to me one time, I can't wait to get to heaven where I can eat a dozen donuts. Something was off there. I thought about it for a moment. I said, I can't wait to get to heaven and be satisfied with eating half a donut and put the other half down without feeling like I've got to stuff that down my throat. That's what Jesus starts to do in reordering your passions. If he's made you alive, you have the beginnings of those desires now. To be filled with Jesus more than you're filled with donuts, more than you're filled with politics, more than you're filled with power or anything else. He's made you spiritually alive when you were once dead because of his great love for you. This world is filled with great hate. It always has been. Sometimes that hate breaks out in horrible violence that should not surprise us. It broke out in violence to kill the Son of God. If humanity was willing to murder the Son of God, nothing is beyond us, which means what? Nothing is beyond you and me because we're all on the same side of the room. Sometimes our world is horribly violent. Sometimes the violence goes underground. It'll emerge somewhere else at another time. Parents, please do not shelter your children from that reality. You don't need to frighten them. Please don't do that. But you need to give them a way of understanding. This is what we're really like inside. The same things that drive other people to be this ugly to others are in you and me too. And this is why, you say this to your kids, this is why we need to be saved. That's a word that it's out of favor now. We don't like that word. We don't use it. Use it. Use it in your home. That's why Jesus came to this earth. Not to condemn it, even though he should have, but he came to seek and to save the lost, to seek and to save you and me, to seek and to save our children. Your children, this opportunity for you, your children need to know right now that they need to be saved from themselves. And they need to be saved from themselves more than they need to be saved from anything else. And God, who is rich in mercy, filled with great love, has made a way to do that. God's passion is to save individuals, to transform spiritually dead hearts by making us alive, by uniting us with Christ. That's what we celebrate in communion. So let me invite you now, spend a few minutes to get your heart ready. And if you're with your family, help your children. Gather them around you, pray with them, talk with them. Help yourself, help them see what it cost to make you alive, and make sure that you see the great love that God has for you to freely pay that cost. Let's spend a few minutes.